Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Mm-hmm.
Today we are immersing ourselves in the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography. His name is George Floyd. One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice.
Right.
This really extraordinary work by Washington Post reporters Robert Samuels and Toulouse Olorunipa, it challenges us fundamentally to look beyond the name that became, you know, synonymous with the global movement and truly understand the man.
That's precisely our mission today. It's really an act of journalistic restoration, I think.
Yeah.
We are charting the full 46 years of George Perry Floyd Jr.'s life. You know, the father, the athlete, the security guard, the artist, to really transform how we understand him. Mm. His story, it shows that his significance isn't just about how he died, but about the complexity, the sheer complexity of the life he navigated.
A life defined by, well, towering dreams on one hand and the relentless pressure of structural realities in America on the other.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the book's central argument, it seems, is that we gain nothing by reducing him to a symbol, whether that's a symbol of martyrdom or even moral failure.
Right, those simple labels just don't work.
To grasp the full, profound tragedy of his final minutes, the book says we must meticulously examine the decades that came before.
All those years, seeing how his potential, his humanity, was consistently undercut by forces often way outside his personal control.
So let's ground this in context first.
Bleh.
George Floyd Jr., people called him Big Floyd. He was a physically imposing man, right? 6'7".
Huge man, yeah. And known for being a deeply protective brother, a standout high school football star.
Also a security guard later on. And he even had this a significant role as Big Floyd in the Houston hip-hop scene, part of this screwed up clique.
Yeah, an influential collective. But what's crucial, I think, for you listening is seeing this not just as one unique individual story.
Mm-hmm.
It's really presented as a case study in American inequality. The biography insists on grounding his life in the tangible, complex reality of what it means to be a Black man trying to pursue dignity, opportunity.
While navigating these deliberate economic and social barriers.
Barriers that were very real. His story begins in Houston's Third Ward, specifically the public housing complex CUNY Homes, known locally as the Bricks.
Right. And the book paints it as a place of, well, significant economic scarcity, obviously, but also one with this powerful sense of community, resilience, culture.
Things that profoundly shaped him from the start.
And right at the center of that world was his mother, Larsenia Sissy Floyd.
Absolutely central.
She seems to be the unwavering anchor. The reporters really beautifully document how she instilled in him this deep faith and just a fundamental kindness.
Yeah. There's that anecdote in the book. It's quite heartbreaking, actually.
How about the height markings?
Yes. Him constantly marking his height on the apartment wall as a boy, literally measuring his growth, dreaming of becoming big enough.
Big enough to earn enough, protect enough.
Yes.
Just lift his family out of that poverty. It's such a visual.
It really is. And if we look back even further at the historical roots, that struggle wasn't just random. It wasn't accidental.
The book connects it back generations.
It does. It traces his lineage back to his great-great-grandfather, Hillary Thomas Stewart, who was actually a beacon of early success after emancipation, amassed something like 500 acres.
Wow, 500 acres. That's substantial.
Huge. But that wealth, that foundational opportunity, it was systematically stripped away over generations.
Oh, what happened?
Things like, you know, predatory debt, unfairly high taxation, outright land seizures by white landowners, the usual tragic story for many Black families.
So that ancestral theft, as the book frames it, sets the stage for the economic and racial barriers Floyd himself would face generations later.
Exactly. The family was constantly forced to start over, essentially.
That makes the whole narrative around his athletic years even more poignant, doesn't it?
It really does. He was a genuine standout at Jack Yates High School, earned that nickname, Gentle Giant. Sports looked like his first clear path out, his first real hope.
This is where the system, as the book argues, intervened directly.
Mm-hmm. Despite having the raw talent, maybe enough for a major scholarship, he struggled to meet the necessary academic requirements to actually accept one.
Why was that?
Well, the chronic underfunding of schools like Jack Yates, it meant he just didn't get the essential tutoring or, you know, the remedial academic support he needed to bridge that gap.
So a failure of infrastructure, not necessarily his own lack of will or effort.
That's how the book presents it. And that single failure effectively closed off his most promising, his most legitimate pathway to economic mobility at that time.
Wow. That moment, that realization that the door was basically shut, that must have been a profound turning point.
Absolutely devastating for a young man with those dreams.
So he pivoted. He ends up returning to the Third Ward.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he finds this sort of local celebrity as Big Floyd in the Houston hip-hop scene.
Right, within the Screwed Up clique, which was hugely influential locally.
But was that purely about fame? Or was it also kind of tied into the very things he was trying to escape, like the street economy?
That's a really key tension the biography explores. On one hand, it offered him a sense of dignity, respect, maybe validation that the formal economy was denying him.
He was somebody in that world.
He was somebody, a voice, an artist. But you're right, that fame was also deeply intertwined with the informal street economy.
An economy that was heavily policed, heavily targeted.
Precisely. Which inevitably led to that cycle of arrests. Smaller offenses at first, but culminating in the 2007 aggravated robbery conviction.
And then a 5-year prison sentence. That must have felt like the absolute end of the road.
It was devastating, no doubt. But the book, again, handles this moment with important nuance. It acknowledges the personal choices, the consequences.
But it also frames it within a larger context.
Yes. It frames his life as constantly running into a system that disproportionately policed communities like the Third Ward and then offered severely limited second chances, especially for Black men with a felony record.
So the justice system wasn't really about rehabilitation in his experience.
It functioned more as a mechanism of control and exclusion, according to the author's analysis of his life and the lives of others like him.
Okay, so if the system seemed almost designed to fail him, how did the book square that systemic view with the personal choices he made? Was there a moment of, like, personal accountability that allowed him to eventually move forward?
Oh, absolutely. The book doesn't shy away from that. Right. The incarceration itself, those 5 years, they served as a forced, powerful reckoning for him.
How so?
Well, the biography details how he engaged really deeply with faith during that time with ministry programs inside prison.
Oh, okay.
And when he emerged, he seemed to have this conscious, very resolute intention to change his life. He apparently told family members, "I'm through, you know, with that past life."
I'm through. That's powerful.
It is. And that commitment to personal overhaul, that's really the engine that drove his next major life-altering move.
Which was the move to Minneapolis in 2014.
Exactly.
That decision, I mean, leaving his entire family, his whole support network back in Houston, that seems like such a radical act of hope, almost self-preservation.
It absolutely was a huge leap of faith. And, you know, initially it really seemed to work.
Yeah.
This move, it was facilitated by a Christian work program, and it gave him several years of relative stability. He found real purpose working as a security guard.
At the Salvation Army Harbor Light Center, right?
That's the one. Oh. And colleagues there, they often described him as a genuine peacemaker.
The gentle giant again.
Yeah, using his physical size not to intimidate, but actually to de-escalate conflicts. With, by all accounts, immense kindness and dignity, really trying to live out that nickname in his adult working life.
That stability, though,
yeah. It
didn't last indefinitely.
No, the relentless pressures of life, maybe those structural stresses we talked about, they eventually seemed to wear him down again.
What happened specifically?
Two major things hit him hard. First, the profound grief following the death of his mother, Sissy, in 2018. She was his rock.
That must have been devastating.
Absolutely. And then the job loss during the 2020 pandemic. Those combined stressors, the grief, and the economic precarity, they exacerbated his ongoing struggle with opioid addiction.
Which the book addresses, frankly.
Yes, it does. So if we connect this all to the bigger picture, his death wasn't just some isolated random incident.
Yeah.
The book argues it was the tragic culmination of navigating this systemic minefield his entire life.
A lifetime of economic inequality, struggles with addiction, often rooted in trauma and lack of opportunity, and this punitive justice system.
Exactly. And that is why his final minutes resonated so deeply and sparked a global movement. His life, in many ways, encapsulated the burden carried by millions of people. It forced a reckoning on racial justice precisely because it wasn't just about him.
When you synthesize his worldview, though, despite all that struggle, it seems rooted in, well, faith, definitely, community care.
Yeah.
And this almost tragic optimism about transformation.
A persistent optimism, yeah. He genuinely seemed to believe in redemption. In second chances.
That philosophy he often shared with younger people, it's one of the most powerful things in the book for me. He told them, your past don't have to be your permanent.
Such a powerful quote. And that intense optimism, that drive, it seemed fueled by maybe three core motivations the book identifies.
Okay, what were they?
Firstly, and probably most importantly, making Sissy proud.
Yeah.
His mother, she was the emotional anchor, and validating her sacrifices, her belief in him, seems to have driven almost everything he tried to do.
That makes sense. What else?
Secondly, being a good father, especially to his daughter Gianna. The book shows his consistent effort to provide, to maintain that connection despite the distance, despite his own challenges.
Okay, making Sissy proud, being a good father,
no.
And the third.
Community uplift. This desire to be a man of peace. Even in Minneapolis, he was trying to mentor young people through informal outreach, through church work.
Constantly trying to prove his worth, maybe, through service to others.
Perhaps. But here's the tragic tension the book highlights so well. His powerful personal resilience, his drive, was constantly being worn down.
By what?
By the sheer stress of navigating a society that in so many ways devalued his humanity. That chronic stress, it manifested in periods of depression, self-medication, relapse.
It shows that personal will alone, however strong, sometimes just can't indefinitely fight against deeply entrenched structural oppression.
That seems to be a central argument. You need both personal effort and systemic change.
So to really understand the full scope of his life, the biography seems to anchor on three specific moments. Three pivotal turning points that fundamentally altered his path.
Yes, we've touched on them, but it's helpful to pull them out. These are the critical forks in the road.
Okay, the first one, which we discussed earlier, was the failure to secure that major college athletic scholarship right after high school.
Transformative, because it closed off his most promising, most legitimate path to upward mobility.
Forcing him back into the cycles of poverty in the Third Ward and towards the street economy, the hip-hop scene. Things that offered maybe temporary dignity, but carried long-term peril.
Precisely. That was turning point one, the second pivotal moment.
His 2007 incarceration, the 5-year sentence.
Right. Which, while obviously restrictive and damaging in many ways, also served as that powerful, necessary reckoning we talked about.
The time where he engaged with faith ministry.
Exactly. And emerged with that conscious, powerful resolve to overhaul his life. It set the psychological stage for what came next.
Which was the third turning point. The move to Minneapolis in 2014.
Yes. And this wasn't just changing locations. The book portrays it as a deep psychological and spiritual attempt at transformation.
It gave him those years of stability, a new community.
And crucially, the precious chance to redefine himself as a positive mentor, a worker. It demonstrated his profound capacity for change, even acknowledging the challenges that eventually resurfaced.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, I think. What does living a life like George Floyd's, as documented in this book, teach us about the universal human experience?
Well, one major thing is witnessing that constant, absolutely exhausting battle. The battle that happens when deep personal drive and resilience slams up against the immovable object of systemic oppression.
It's a story about complexity, isn't it?
Absolutely. The biggest lesson is probably the need to reject those false, simplistic dichotomies. Was he a saint or a villain? The book demands we see he was all of it.
A mentor, a father, a kind soul.
Who also struggled profoundly with addiction, who had a criminal record. His story demands that we embrace the full, complicated, sometimes contradictory humanity in him and, by extension, in everyone.
So to honor his life is really to acknowledge the context that created both his struggles and his profound capacity for love and connection.
Exactly. And that dignity can transcend circumstances. There's that beautiful insight from the book. Big Floyd had a way of making everyone feel like they mattered. That
yeah.
Deep commitment to showing respect, regardless of his own economic situation or past mistakes, that feels like his enduring human legacy.
Empathy has to begin with understanding the context.
Right.
Understanding the whole 46 years before those final minutes.
That's the core message. So let's try to distill the main findings of this incredible biography into three final powerful lessons.
Okay. Three takeaways.
First, an emotional insight. I think the deepest emotional truth that runs through the entire narrative is that profound, lifelong connection between George and his mother, Sissy.
Mm.
Here's this man, 6'6", and yet in his final moments of absolute distress, he cries out for his mother. To truly understand George Floyd, you have to understand that in his heart, he was always Sissy's son, fundamentally seeking safety, security, maybe redemption in her eyes.
Wow. Okay, that's powerful. What's the second?
Second, an intellectual insight. George Floyd's life was essentially a collision course with a structural system often designed to limit opportunity and punish vulnerability for people like him.
Right.
Systemic inequality isn't just some abstract theory. The book shows it as a series of concrete, tangible barriers. The underfunded schools, the history of land theft in his family, economic disenfranchisement, a predatory justice system. His death, tragically, feels like the conclusion of navigating that societal minefield for decades.
A minefield he couldn't ultimately escape. And a third insight.
Third, a universal insight. It's this. Every single person is infinitely more complex than their worst mistake, and every person's life holds inherent unalienable value.
Mm-hmm.
We have to learn, maybe force ourselves to see the entire person. The book talks about the 24 million minutes that came before the final nine, not just that single final horrific frame, because every life in its messy, complicated entirety matters.
So what does this all mean? Taking this deep dive, exploring this life from Cooney Holmes to becoming this global symbol. What's the takeaway?
I think it means acknowledging that personal resilience, like Floyd showed again and again, is absolutely vital, but it's not enough on its own.
It has to be paired with collective action.
Yes. Collective action to actually dismantle the structural barriers that constrained his potential and continue to constrain so many others. The book doesn't just tell his story. It implicitly provides a map for that kind of action by showing exactly where the systems failed him.
And the book ensures we cannot comfortably remember George Floyd as only a symbol, whether positive or negative.
Absolutely not. To truly honor him, the authors argue, is to extend that same humanizing perspective to others in our own communities, people who are struggling with similar burdens, similar challenges.
And to actively fight the systems, whether they're educational, economic, criminal justice, that limit human potential and deny basic dignity.
That's the call to action embedded in this biography. It's a demand for systemic change, rooted in the deep understanding of one man's life.
A profound and frankly necessary deep dive. We really encourage you, the listener, to continue exploring these complex connections between individual lives and the vast structural forces that shape them. Thank you for joining us. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.